I have told you, this church, before that I am a little brother. I have one sibling, an older brother, Reed, who is a doctor in the sometimes godforsaken city of Dallas, Texas. Reed is 2 years and 2 months older than I am. And by virtue of the reality of birth order, I spent almost the entirety of my childhood trying somehow to live 2 years and 2 months in advance of my own childhood reality. I have an episodic memory as a child of making my way across the living room in our house at 4019 Betsy Lane, wearing a pair of my brother's trousers that were thoroughly 70s. They were like these cream-colored pants with rainbow vertical stripes. And I rolled them up, and I was holding them up as I moved across the room. When I finally made it to T-ball, I didn't enjoy the tee, but longed for the pitching machine. And when I finally made it to pitching machine, I longed for there to be a real baseball player in the mound throwing the ball across the plate. When my brother went off to summer camp 2 years before I was allowed to go, I longed to spend the summer in the mountains of northeastern New Mexico, but was relegated to hot Houston, Texas. When I was 14 or 15 years old, I thought it was absolutely unjust that I couldn't drive a car around the city of Houston, so much so that when my mom was not yet home from work and my brother was not paying careful attention, I would don a pair of Ray-Ban aviator sunglasses. This was right when, like, the movie Top Gun came out. I would don a pair of Ray-Ban aviator sunglasses and take a, like, thoroughly 1980s, like, bucket tennis hat and pull it down over most of my face. I would steal my brother's keys and drive his car to Burger King for an afternoon snack. One Sunday afternoon when I was at the birthday party for one of my friends, my friend John, his father, Mr. Eichenberg, came and sat down next to me. And he leaned over and he whispered into my ear, "Jimmy, you're not fooling anyone in those sunglasses and the hat." And I immediately responded to him without missing a beat, "Please don't tell my mom, Mr. Eichenberg. For some reason, I always wanted to be just a little more grown up than I was. And I think that's a real, it's a real problem in our culture. We have a tendency to speed up childhood, to accelerate out of our present moment and into some unknown, unmanaged, not understood future. There is this trajectory or this pressure that we can put on ourselves. I remember when I turned 50, someone asked me, they're like, "Ooh, how does this feel?" And I was like, "It feels great." I mean, honestly, like when I was in my late 20s, I joined this profession where you're supposed to be wise. And there is no wisdom in your late 20s. There's experience and there's certainty, but there's very little wisdom, right? So it's like finally getting some gray in this beard and in this hair is a welcome change for me. We spend so much of our energy in living out of the present moment and into the future as people, and yet we get these curious bits of wisdom, one that we have from today's ninth chapter of the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus says these curious things like, you know, "You may not enter the kingdom of heaven unless you become like one of these little children." We try so hard to grow up, and Jesus seems to be delivering us this message of like, the trajectory of your life is not growing up, but rather growing down. That's how we access the reality of the kingdom of heaven while we are still living and breathing. I think in order for us to have a real clear picture of just what Jesus is saying, we have to have a real understanding of the whole story itself, or at least of the entire 9th chapter of Mark's gospel. So I'm going to go back a little bit. Bear with me. Sometimes when I preach these sermons that come from a paragraph from the lectionary, I feel like I stand up and I tell you a story about a movie that you have not yet seen. Or perhaps I begin to give commentary about a movie that you've seen like one scene from, but not the entire movie itself. And so we kind of miss the point. So if we go back to the very beginning of the 9th chapter of Mark, which sets the scene for the wisdom that Jesus is really dropping down into the disciples that he's teaching, and those of us who consider ourselves disciples or aspiring disciples here today. If we look at the very beginning of that chapter, the first beat in that chapter is the transfiguration. You may remember, you may not remember, that there's this moment, this mystical moment, where Jesus grabs a portion of his disciples, the C-suite, the executive committee of the disciples, and he goes to the top of Mount Tabor. And there's this mystical thing that happens when they get to the top of the mountain. Now, this is something we know a little bit about here, those of us who live in Jackson Hole. Mystical things do happen on tops of mountains. It's a beautiful thing. This thing is characterized first by a white light, where Jesus' clothes become dazzling white, like so much so that you have to put those Ray-Ban aviators on in order to make out who he is. And then the most important detail of the story itself is not that Jesus becomes transfigured, but rather who he finds himself in company with on top of that mountain. Moses and Elijah appear to be alongside Jesus. And it's this confusing experience for the disciples. And we should know, particularly in the Gospel of Mark, that the disciples are noted for or characterized by confusion. Now, don't hear what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that the disciples are not like smart, faithful people. Of course they are. But this reality that we find in the Gospel of Mark around confused disciples narrates into a reality that we experience as human beings trying to embody the faith. This idea of like, wow, like no matter how often I come to church and how many days I live, this whole like living as a disciple or living as a spiritual being can be confusing from time to time. So it's not that these guys are numbskulls or that they're ignorant. It's that they're trying to live into this reality as human beings. And when we human beings try to straddle the divide between the kingdom of the world and the kingdom of heaven, it's confusing. It's confusing for those who are right at the very center of this emerging experience. So the disciples are trying to make sense of what this means. And what we're meant to hear in the presence of Moses and Elijah is for us to go all the way back to the beginning of the story, where God is doing God's work, God's creative and loving act in creation, building this reality that is a reality of interdependence, of collaborative experience, while each creature and each aspect of creation is dependent upon the other. Remember when creation itself falls apart, the thing that it falls apart around is independence. Now, this is a frustrating reality for Americans and Westerners, and particularly for like us, like inner Mountain West Americans, where we're like, no, we cowboy up. We pull ourselves up from our bootstraps. We're self-sufficient. That's where things go wrong in the story, when humanity reaches for fruit and says, you know what? I got this. We got this. And then things get out of sync because we were built for love. We were built for cooperation. We were built for partnership and collaboration, meant to interact with one another and with creation itself. And so what Mark, the gospeler, the evangelist, is signaling here is that he's reminding us that we are built. We are built for interdependence, for relationship one to another. And then there's this next wonderful beat of the story, which we get a little snippet of, and we need to hear it in the context of the development of Israel's faith over time. As Israel moves from interdependence into the fall of independence and develops religious practice that becomes institutionalized, one of the things that is lost is love, is care. We human beings, especially those of us who are insistent upon our independence, we attach ourselves to power, to hierarchy. It's how we distinguish ourselves one from another. And so we begin to create these rules around religious expression and practice. And the disciples are engaging a crowd where there is a man who has a child who is suffering. The man himself is not suffering. And all of us who are parents in this room know this to be true. The man himself is not suffering. It's even worse. It is his child who is suffering. And the disciples, the scribes are there. The religious professionals like me are there. They've got their eye on things. The disciples are there. And the disciples are like, We tried to heal him, but we couldn't really pull it off. And what we're meant to hear is like, they're scared. They're stuck in this power thing where all the rules say, like, you can't touch him. You can't really get near him, that kid who's struggling. Because if you do, you're going to soil yourself. You're going to be ritually unclean, and you won't be able to do what religious people like us are supposed to do. And so they just put their toe in, but Jesus jumps in with both feet, right? And he reminds this dad, just by virtue of the fact that you have come to ask for help, just by virtue of the fact that you are acknowledging your need for an interdependent, cooperative relationship, by acknowledging the fact that you are powerless to the reality of your son has been made well. You have been restored to your original created being, having a sense of who you are and who you are made to be by virtue of saying, I need help. Counter that power dynamic, that power context, which says, like, never let them see you sweat. Only cry when you close the bathroom door and you're in the bathroom by yourself, right? Jesus is building this growing understanding, this tension between the world of interdependence and independence, this tension between the world of love and the world of power that our sacred story calls the kingdom of the world and the kingdom of heaven. Right after this moment, there is this humorous interlude. And maybe we don't hear it as humorous, but it's meant to be. It's meant to be funny. After Jesus has taken the hierarchy and flattened it completely, and the disciples are still left in their confusion, the very next conversation that they have, when they are out of earshot of Jesus, is like, out of the 12 of us, who do you think is number one? I think it's me. Do you think it's me? This is a marvelous myth, story, narrative, sacred scripture around this reality that we human beings live in and around. In order to shake them up, Jesus delivers this beautiful, like, pedagogical moment where he's like, all of you grown-up people, if you want to get it, you need to become like little children. You need to soften yourselves. You need to open your hearts one to another. You need to engage each other in transparent communication like children have. It's so refreshing. And some, you know, and honestly, it's not refreshing as a first-time parent. But if you're holding that second baby that's like fussy and squirmy, as what you realize really quickly is like, this is one of the one human beings on the earth in my orbit right now who's just absolutely, utterly transparent about what they're feeling and needing, right? I mean, the baby cries and you know the baby needs attention. The baby laughs and you know the baby is connecting with you in that way. And Jesus is like, no, we were built for that kind of natural connection one with another. And we see it happen on the playground, right? You know, one kid comes up to another and says like, hey, Bruce, do you like trucks? Bruce is like, yeah, I like trucks. And he's like, I got some trucks over here. Let's go play. And then when things go wrong, right, it can get a little hot. That's my truck. No, that's my truck. But it's only hot for a moment, right? They figure it out. They figure it out pretty quickly, that conflict that experiences between them, and they just move on from it in a glorious way where there were tears 95 seconds ago. There's belly laughter happening right after that. It is a glorious way to make our way through life, living with the openness and the softness of children. It is what we were built for, what we were made to do and be, not empowered people, empowered by our own instinct and our own strength and our own intellect and our own experience, but loving people, connected one to another through compassion and loving kindness and partnership. That's the difference that we get. And so, why do we talk about this on a Sunday morning? Beautiful first day of fall, crisp air, blazing sun, leaves beginning to turn, elk beginning to bugle. Well, we talk about it because we're not really oriented toward the kingdom of heaven, but rather to the world. You may have observed within the context of our culture as of late that we find ourselves divided. Yes, you know this. In my 54 years of walking the face of the earth, I don't believe the United States of America has ever been more divided. Now, I didn't live through the 60s and the counterculture revolution. I was born in the 70s, so I can only speak for myself here. In the last 54 years, I have never seen us more divided. It is so incredibly painful for us to witness, especially when we are both drawn to something different, but we are also drawn to the reality of the conflict that exists before us. We have such a tendency to go to us and them. And it's a lesson for us, right? Because we can sit back under this beautiful bubble of Jackson Hole and we can say like, well, really, you know, this is terrible and we experience it and we're suffering under it and those people in Washington need to get it together, or those people in Cheyenne need to get it together, or those people across the street need to get it together, when in fact, Jesus is pushing this wisdom down into each of our lives. But when we receive it through the context of scripture read in church or a sermon preached, we have this tendency to exonerate ourselves. Like, yeah, it's really important, but it's not really about us. But I'm saying it's about us. This is the place where we begin to heal. And by virtue of the fact that we are sitting here together on Sunday morning, this is the time. This is the time, and this is the place, and we are the people to attach ourselves to love rather than power. Now, maybe you're scratching your heads, and you're thinking, Jimmy, what does that even look like? How can it be? I have a beautiful example for you that I witnessed. Those of you who are in and around this church from time to time know that I am like a parent who, well, it's complicated. I'm not an empty nester because I have a child who is disabled who will always be with us. But our one kid that was launching out of the nest at some point has launched. Cindy and I dropped our daughter Jade off at Bowdoin College about 3.5 weeks ago. And that's an anxiety-provoking experience for all three of us, for all different reasons, and some are the same, right? But I'll say we dropped Jade off on a Monday, and Sunday night, I didn't sleep very well. I was like, man, we spent like 90 minutes at each of these 12 schools, and somehow we said like, well, it's that one. And here she is. And we're going to leave her here for 4 years. It was weird. It was weird. I mean, it was good. There were aspects of it that were great and beautiful, but it was also a little hard and a little weird. And it was weird for all of us, and I could tell that Cindy was anxious, and I most certainly was. And gosh, my darling daughter Jade was too. And so we get up, and we're doing our thing, and we're not talking a whole lot. I think everyone's just kind of like, wow, like this is the day. Like, we've arrived. We're going to hug this kid, and we're going to get on a plane and in Maine and go back to Wyoming. I mean, I Googled it. I was like, could she have gone any farther? If she had gone to the University of Miami, she would have gone like 50 miles farther. She went the second farthest away she could get from her parents. We moved her in that morning. We met her roommate, who's absolutely delightful, and they've become friends. We met her roommate's mother, who was helping us helping her daughter move in. It was a wonderful experience. At midday, Cindy and Jade and I walked to the dining hall, and we had lunch together. And as we were making our way out of the dining hall, Cindy was like, hey, I'm going to run to the restroom. And Jade and I were like, okay, we'll meet you outside. And as we walked outside, and it's like, you know, everyone is sizing each other up, right? It's just like every set of eyes walking across campus, especially the ones who are 18 and under, are like, are you my people? Are you going to be my friend? Or are you my enemy? I don't know who you are yet. And we're walking outside. Jade and I are walking out together. And here's another young woman who's with her parents too. Mom and dad and daughter coming, and this girl just walks by Jade, and as she walks by Jade, she looks up and she says, hey, I like your outfit. Oh, I watched Jade's face brighten and soften, and I felt my heart just go like, yes, that's it. And as we were moving out, I was like, Jade, I just can't, you know, I mean, I'm your dad, you know me, I can't resist. I'm like, that's God. And Jade was like, the universe, Dad, I call it the universe. And I was like, that's cool. That's cool. I'm fine with that. I'm an Episcopalian. You can call God what you need to call God. You can call God the universe, and I'm fine. You can call God love, and I'm fine with that. You can call God hate, and I go like, no, not that. That's not God. If we are wondering in our minds, how the heck do we get ourselves out of this mess that we find ourselves in? I will tell you, we do it by walking alongside one another, redirecting our gaze and saying, hey, I like your outfit. It didn't go like, hey, are you a Democrat? Because if you are, I like your outfit. Or, hey, are you a Republican? Because if you are, I like your outfit. It was just, hey, I like your outfit. Church, if we are wondering where the end of our division begins, it ends at St. John's Episcopal Church on a Sunday morning in a 10 o'clock service, and it moves on from there. Amen.